affliction.
Come to order. Today is Wednesday, April 1st, 2009. There's overflow room 343, if you don't have a place to sit. First item on the agenda today is House Bill 3071. Open a public hearing. Representative Thatcher, please.
House Bill 3071 requires the State Board of Higher Education to authorize each institution under its control to commission special campus security officers, grants the officers the power and authority of peace officers, and declares an emergency. And you have a dash one amendment in front of you. We do not yet have the fiscal or revenue statements.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I am Representative Kim Thatcher from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburg. And today I bring you House Bill 3071. It is at the request of SEIU and a group of their members who have been trying since 2003 to get the legislature to take them seriously. And last session we actually came close. I'm talking about our campus cops, the people, the men and women who are charged with protecting our students and our faculty at Oregon's seven public institutions of higher education. In 2007, a measure to give these officers full authority, training, equipment, and firearms passed the House 39-18. The measure died in a committee in the Senate in the final days. This time, we're hoping to offer a scaled-down version of the legislation and hopefully be successful this time. This bill is designed to be more of a technical fix to help clean up some of the current statutory language governing special campus security officers. This bill would allow them to be trained as regular police officers and allow them to issue citations for things like minor in possession, DUII, and other common crimes on campus. I don't believe the way the bill is written, the officers would have the ability to carry firearms unless their university gives them the power to do so. But just in case, I have an amendment I am offering that explicitly spells that out so there's no confusion. The amendment also makes it clear that the university system would be responsible for covering the cost of the training. DPSST would not be burdened with this. I also believe that it is implied in the bill, but just to make sure we spell it out, that's in the amendment. This month marks the unfortunate two-year anniversary of the Virginia Tech massacre, and there have been other tragic shootings like Northern Illinois last year, and I hope that we never have any such incidents occur here in Oregon. In the interim, the governor commissioned a task force to look into a variety of things dealing with the safety of Oregon's university system. Greg Marks, a campus safety officer who served on the task force, is here today. OHSU also had a task force, and just yesterday in the Senate Judiciary Committee, a bill to give their officers more authority was heard. Now, both of these study groups came away with the same conclusion. Our campus officers need more authority and better training. I believe House Bill 3071 is a step in the right direction. For those who are new to this issue, I'm sure the officers here today will be happy to answer any of the questions you may have. By way of background, each campus in Oregon has a little different security policy. At Oregon State, there are around 10 Oregon State police troopers contracted to provide security in addition to the campus officers. At the University of Oregon, Eugene Police have a detail contracted to provide services on campus. Other institutions, I've heard the campus officers called things like rent-a-cops and other such terms, and I think it's kind of sad. There's no definition in statute or rule for campus security officer. Campus security is not recognized as a law enforcement unit in our state. But the one thing that is spelled out in law, the only people expressly prohibited from carrying firearms on campus are campus security officers and felons. House Bill 3071 is a starting point, a small way we can help these law enforcement officers do their job, albeit without firearms at this time, and do their job to the best of their abilities and provide the best protection possible under our current system. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you for all the time you've put in working on this over the last few sessions. Appreciate that, your effort. And I would ask that in your testimony, if you could be as brief as possible, we have a full schedule today. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Greg Marks. I'm a representative of SEIU. I'm also a campus public safety officer at PSU, and I also served on the governor's task force that addressed the campus safety issue. I have a letter, a statement for you of SEIU's standpoint on this, and I also have, if you haven't had a chance, the report from the governor's task force. Well, I served the governor's task force. We served for about 6 months, and we discussed this. We had many representatives from all over the state coming out for testimony. And House Bill 3071 comes forward with some of those recommendations from the task force. One of those explicit recommendations that's in there, it's on page 6, is that the law that grants us our authority should be amended, and campus public safety officers should be granted the authority for violations. It also says that campus public safety officers should receive adequate training. It's standardized training and training that best fits the campus community. If the other recommendations is that the one of the reasons we went with that, right now campus public safety officers have full arrest authority but are only mandated to receive 8 hours of training. And if that was really something to wrap people's heads around, is police officers have to go to 16 weeks to get arrest authority, but a campus cop only has to have 8 hours. That's not adequate training. This is something that we took serious because the students are Oregon's future leaders and workers, and we have to do everything possible to protect them. If anybody has any questions, I'd be more than happy to address them.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Barber, members of the committee, my name is Mike Silver. I've been working on the campus safety bills for the last 4 years. I currently own a campus safety consulting company. I'm also on a national task force for community policing involving campus safety. I'm also currently working as a public safety officer at Western Oregon University. That's where I'll be drawing my experience from, and I'm a member of SEIU. For the last 4 years or several years, we've been trying to change the bill and trying to change our abilities to serve our campus communities. We have limited abilities. We have probable cause arrest authority, but if we go into a room that has students and non-students mixed in, we are forced to contact an outside law enforcement agency. That outside law enforcement agency has to use their resources and criminally cite everybody in the room should there be a need. By giving us this authority in House Bill 3071, we would be able to take the students of OUS and be able to send them to judicial conduct board, and the non-students would be issued a criminal site. This would provide a standardization for our training, our hiring practices, as well as our professionalism and our abilities to perform our duties for the campus communities.
This bill does not
authorize firearms.
That was a major contention.
People are very concerned about that. We're looking to be able to perform our duties the best we can, and that's what this bill does. We are willing at this time to work with anybody, whether it be OUS, OSA, anybody, to make this bill a workable bill. We've got to be able to utilize our public safety professionals on these campuses in a manner that benefits everyone. The citations, we talk about cost, we talk about the cost of training, we talk about the cost of so many different avenues over the last 4 years. This would essentially have no cost to our estimation at this point. It would require a minimal amount more training than what we already get that the university pays for. Not what's mandated, what the university already pays for. We would be able to write violation citations into the local community courts, the circuit courts, which portion of those funds get turned over to DPSST to pay for training. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions from the panel? Representative Krieger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk to us a little bit about your present hiring criteria
background checks as that relates to the quality of the type of people that you can hire?
Chair, Representative Krieger.
That varies from campus to campus. At PSU, PSU, U of O, and at Western Oregon University, we require an application process, a written exam, which is the same exam a police officer must take, a formal interview, a background process. At PSU, I believe they're doing psychological tests. U of O, I'm not sure if they're doing psychs, but there are people here from U of O that can answer that. OSU is a little bit different hiring practice. South is even different from that. East and OIT, I believe theirs is just an application and interview process. I don't know if they're doing complete backgrounds or not.
Follow up, please.
The people, in other words, the sheriff has a unit that looks at prospective members of the department, state police, all your big city police departments do that. And those people have a lot of training and expertise just in the hiring. And I'm wondering, how does each individual college, where are you drawing from to get that expertise?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, and members of this committee, each one of our university campuses have former law enforcement officers, law enforcement administrators. Myself, I was a police officer in the state of Oregon since 1990 prior to coming to the university. So each university has the capability, the experience, and the knowledge to perform background investigations and hiring practices in accordance with the rules and the OARs of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Scott Cameron.
Mike Anderson.
Please go ahead, just identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, my name is Scott Cameron. I am a public safety officer, a corporal at the University of Oregon. I don't represent the University of Oregon. All I can attest to is what the officers have told me and what my experience has been with the students and staff at the University of Oregon. There are people here that will probably testify as to what the University of Oregon's point of view is on this bill, but I can ensure you that at least the students and the staff and at least the public safety officers at the University of Oregon have come to expect law enforcement from its campus public safety officers. Most students that are entering college nowadays have grown up with school resource officers at their middle schools and their high schools. They've come to expect law enforcement on campus. We live in Lane County, which is having trouble with its law enforcement at this point in time, and resources are very thin. It is not uncommon for us to take someone into custody and have to wait 20 minutes before local law enforcement can arrive to take custody of them or to issue them a citation in lieu of custody. All we're asking for is the ability to issue these people citations in lieu of custody and speed the process up. This is safer for the officers who don't have to wait with someone in handcuffs, and it's more of a courtesy to the people who are being charged with a crime. The campus has got upwards of 20,000 people on it who have come to expect the public safety officers there to do law enforcement for them. We take their initial reports, we conduct the initial investigation, and then we usually turn it over to Eugene Police before, so it can be adjudicated, whether that be with a citation or an arrest. The reality is, on the University of Oregon campus, most people don't dial 911. They call us, and we are the first responders there. This has become a safety issue for a lot of reasons. The prime example is we respond to someone who is considered just a trespasser, and we find out it's a domestic dispute, there's been an assault. It's a danger for the officers. And I don't think that we're asking for anything too extreme here. I think we're just asking for the ability to do our jobs better than what we're doing now. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
My name is Michael Anderson. I'm an SEIU member. I'm also a public safety officer at Portland State University, and that's where I will be drawing my experience from. I'm going to attempt to not repeat my colleagues at all so that, that we can get going here. Just to give a little bit of history on this subject, back in 2006, Portland State University held a poll that our public safety office did on what our community expects from its public safety office. In that poll, our community said that they expect police services, everything that we can do up to the point of needing a firearm. In 2008, early 2008, the chancellor for the Oregon University system asked each campus to have a committee, so to speak, about what they expect from their public safety office. Portland State University and the University of Oregon returned with the same conclusion. They want as much in the way of police services as they can get from their public safety office. My experience at Portland State University, I think, offers up a more coherent community policing model. I'll talk about that a little bit. It's great to have municipal police officers respond to the campus. They're well trained. 16 weeks is great, but just like every small city wants to have a police department that's dedicated to the special needs of their community, that's kind of what our public safety offices do. When we phone in our calls, unfortunately, because of the fiscal situation here in the state of Oregon, if we need police coverage, our calls are not always the highest of priority, which is why we are trying to get as much authority as we can under the current law. And I would say at this time in Oregon, where we're financial, we're
for the fiscal impact is so
tight, that with a simple law change, it would be far more efficient for us to grant all the authority we can to our public safety officers. This is what our communities want. We know our communities best. We work with them every single day. I personally am a former student from the university system. I've worked there for 3.5 years. I'm the residence life liaison. I continually meet with our community members, and I have an ongoing understanding of what it is that they need and can best tailor policing to their needs. Unfortunately, municipal police don't have the time or resources to devote that kind of expertise to our campuses. And I think that does a great detriment to what is effectively a small city within a city. Portland State University has over 30,000 staff, students, and faculty. And with that, I think I will draw to a conclusion. I appreciate you allowing me to speak to you, and I am happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Mike Anderson, is that right?
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Anderson, for your testimony. So under this bill, I just want to be clear about what it would allow you to do that you're not able to do now. What this allow you to do is issue a citation to a non-student and take a non-student into custody, or you can already take a non-student into custody, and this would allow you not to also issue them a citation.
Currently, we can take students and non-students into custody for any law violation. Where we're lacking, at least for my campus, is in violation authority. I like to pose it as I could arrest somebody for the crime of murder, but I can't give a citation for minor possession of alcohol.
Okay. Follow up? Any instances in which that's been where you said, wow, that would have really been, you know, like maybe one or two examples, maybe one example for time, since I know there's probably other people who want to talk, where that would have been really valuable to you?
Well, as we all know, college is a time for experimentation. There is a lot of marijuana use, and there's a lot of drinking. It's part of the culture. And I'm not talking about getting hard on students and citing everybody. What I am saying is that from a liability standpoint, Because of the fact that it's not plausible to call for municipal police to do violations on a regular basis, we're kind of stuck with, for somebody that's a non-student, sending them on their way with no repercussions. And to me, that seems unfair that a student will more than likely end up in judicial, with judicial consequences from the university, but non-students are sent on their way because we have no authority over them and we can't take that step with them. I mean, I could draw on parties I've been to where this is the truth, but I think that kind of covers what you're asking, Representative.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any further questions? Hey, can I just would add, I was a student at Portland State a few years back, I graduated from UP, and as an officer working second night in Portland, police officer working second night, I'd had calls to Portland State, and I didn't know where things were. I mean, when your people needed assistance, it took me quite a while to find them, so I think it would be beneficial. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Cameron Campbell, Doug Tripp, and Doug Park. And please go ahead, just identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Chair Barker, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Cameron Campbell. I'm the Director of Training for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Just a little bit of background, DPSST is neutral on this particular legislation, but we can provide some historic background on this issue. The issue addressed in House Bill 3071 is one of public policy, and any change to the status of the campus public safety officers would, of course, require legislative action. DPSST has worked with the various public safety departments of the Oregon University system, as well as the Oregon Health Sciences University Department of Public Safety, for many years. In the past, DPSST has offered a voluntary campus public safety course that is 5 weeks in length on a fee-for-service basis to the various colleges and universities. The topics covered during this course are criminal law, defensive tactics, report writing, civil liability, health and fitness, hazardous materials, patrol procedures, and several other classes related to public safety and security issues on college campuses. There is currently no legislative definition of a campus public safety officer in DPSST statutes. Currently, campus public safety officers do not meet the definition of police officer in ORS 181610, nor do they work for a law enforcement unit as defined in ORS 181610 subsection 12. This bill would address part of that issue, recognizing the authority of OUS to commission peace officers within the definition of police officer, but to be considered a police officer under ORS 181610 subsection 14, the individual must be employed full-time by a law enforcement unit. Because this particular bill does not make the Oregon University system a law enforcement unit within our statute, it is not clear whether or not the OUS officers described in this bill would be police officers within DPSST's statute. In 1995, the legislature adopted ORS 352-385, which provided the state system of higher education with the ability to commission one or more of their officers as special campus security officers who have the authority to stop and frisk and make probable cause arrests. These officers are specifically prohibited in the statute from carrying firearms as campus officers and are not considered police officers for purposes of DPSST statutes. This statute requires DPSST to train the officers at the expense of the State Board of Higher Education. And by this statute, I mean ORS 352-385. DPSST has not taken a formal position on this particular bill, House Bill 3071, but we are concerned about changes made in this legislation. Particularly, Section 5 of this particular bill would allow DPSST to reimburse Oregon University System for officers attending training at the academy. Funds have not allowed this to happen for more than 20 years, and adding OUS to this section would create more confusion than anything else. The other concern that we have is with the increased workload to our organization. DPSST already has a backlog of city, county, and state law enforcement officers who need to attend basic training at the Oregon Public Safety Academy. This legislation potentially could add up to 50 or more officers, which would need two full basic police classes, to the list of those needing to attend training. There is a fiscal impact to DPSST, which will need to be modified based on the -1 amendments that I saw today, which that has been submitted to the Legislative Fiscal Office. We do look forward to working with members of the Oregon Legislative Assembly and the university system in addressing the issues raised in House Bill 3071. I thank you for your time, and I'm certainly available to answer any questions you may have.
I just want to thank you, Mr. Campbell. The committee had a chance to come over and visit your facility over there, and you're doing an excellent job, we all felt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Job in the training. Is there any questions about this? Okay, please. Next, whoever would like to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We really appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. For the record, my name is Doug Park, and I'm here on behalf of the University of Oregon. And
good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. My name is Doug Tripp, and I am the Director of Public Safety at the University of Oregon. And the purpose that I am here for today is to answer any questions that you may have relative to the administration of campus safety at the University of Oregon.
Okay, thank you. Is there any questions for committee? Thank you very much.
The reason why I'm here today on behalf of the University of Oregon is because the university was concerned about what was actually going to happen with our current campus security. As currently drafted, our primary concern with HB 3071 is that it appeared that it would transform all of our current special campus security officers to something that is more like a full police officer or peace officer. And we certainly appreciate the additional training that would come with that. But it seemed like what the university wants in particular is the flexibility to have both models. So what we'd really like to have is the flexibility to also have the increased enhanced authority that is contemplated by 3071, the increased citation authority and the authority of peace officers, but not have it be necessarily required, so that we could, if the universities wanted to, maintain the model that we currently have, or if it was necessary to do so, we could also add to that the contingent of the special campus security officers as they're defined in 3071. So our primary concern is that we are able to maintain the flexibility to go more towards that professional, better trained officer, but also keep what we have and not be required to switch all of a sudden to one or the other. And if we were required to do that all at once, it's not clear that it would be revenue neutral for the universities. And if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Perlsteiner? Let me get this guy.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Pernsteiner. I'm the Chancellor of the University System. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you briefly today about House Bill 3071. You've already heard that we have somewhat different situations on each of our campuses, and let me sort of recall the two basic models that currently exist and exist under the current statutes. The statute permits each campus to have public safety officers, and all seven of them do. Those officers, as the gentleman from DPSST pointed out to you, have limited police authority that basically amounts to stop and frisk and certain kinds of arrest authority, but do not have the authority to carry firearms and do not have and are not peace officers under the statutes. In order to deal with situations at different campuses, the campuses have the authority now to contract with local or state police agencies to provide complete police service in addition to the public safety services which are offered by the campus public safety officers. Oregon State University, since 1993, has had a contract with the Oregon State Police to do just that, and in fact there is a division of the Oregon State Police located directly on the Corvallis campus. Those officers of state police work hand in hand with the campus public safety officers, who are employees of Oregon State University, to provide the full range of services on that campus. At the University of Oregon, there is a similar contract with the Eugene Police Department that the University of Oregon has concluded. In the other campuses, they do not have similar formal arrangements, but can call upon local law enforcement as needed, and in fact have a tendency to do that when that is required. That's the current situation that we have. Last year, as Greg Marks indicated, I did ask each of the campuses to conduct a review with their students, with their faculty, with their staffs, and with their communities of the campus safety desires and needs of the individual campuses. In most cases, the campuses came back with, we like what we have, it is sufficient to what we need, and they consulted also with their local police agencies in coming up with that report. As Officer Marks indicated, at a couple of the campuses they wished additional authorities. The board considered that carefully, and determined that because the campuses already have the authority to enter into agreements with local police agencies or the state police, that those issues could be dealt with under current statute. It is important, and I think that Doug Park just indicated the importance of being able to maintain both kinds of officers as needed. Both the campus public safety officers who provide a very important service to a community which they understand very well, and the police agencies which provide law enforcement services to that same community as well as the general community. And in any bill which the legislature would adopt, I would hope that the authority which we currently have to allow that distinction to exist on each campus at that campus's option would be able to be continued, because there is a value in having both levels of service. It's been said several times that training is important. And that was in the Governor's Task Force report. That is, in fact, an important dimension of what we're talking about here. And the training that was envisioned there is, in some ways, much different than the kinds of training that is offered currently by DPSST. And that's something that we're having to consider now in very tough budget times of how do we then deal with the kinds of training needed to prepare campus public safety officers adequately to deal with the kinds of issues and communities that they will be working with and are working with on the individual campuses. Communities which may be somewhat different than the community generally would be. It is not clear to me as I sit here today what the value of this bill would be to the arrangement that we currently have, but I am concerned about potential cost. If we were to transition our officers from one status to another, you understand from the DPSST representative that, in fact, we now have a 5-week training program that we pay for. If we were to go to the regular 16-week program, for example, there is a cost to that. And in this fiscal environment, I don't know what that is, but that does concern me. So as you consider how to approach the safety of the campuses, the safety of the communities, please bear in mind what we have has been working pretty well, because it allows us to bring in competent law enforcement agencies to supplement what we do with campus public safety. But it also does it at what probably is a lesser cost than we would incur under at least one interpretation of this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chancellor. And I don't know. I believe the Oregon State and the Oregon State Police are on a contract basis, although I don't know that you would pay for their training. And just personally, I have some concerns that we have highly trained people from the Oregon State Police, which is an excellent department. Nationwide, I'd say it's an excellent department. And we have 10 of them sitting down there, and I worry about a woman on a rural road breaking down without having help. And I turn on the TV and watch a football game and watch 5 troopers running with the coach across the field. And, I mean, I know that's not your relationship, but I have great concern about that. I'd like to see these highly trained officers out working where they can help the public the most. So, any other questions, Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure the best person to answer this question. It may be more than one person. But I've heard different things about the fiscal impact of this bill, and I know that in our current posture, and maybe in this process generally, there is an effort to make sure that in the bill as written, the fiscal impact is as low as possible so that it can clear not merely this committee, but also go through the Ways and Means process. My concern is that even if that effort is successful, I'd want to make sure it wasn't squeezing out the cost to somewhere else where we wouldn't see it. And maybe that was all of what your testimony regarded. But I heard very recently, just before the committee, that that we've resolved, or somebody else actually, I think they may have resolved the fiscal impact. And I'm wanting sort of a gut check on, does that mean we've resolved the fiscal impact, or does that mean we've squeezed it somewhere else? And I just want to make sure that we're being, if we're going to spend the money, let's spend the money, but let's know we're spending the money rather than making somebody else spend the money without us ever even, without us knowing.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, that's an excellent question. I don't know the answer because I have not seen the fiscal impact. There would be one school of thought that would say that because it's permissive and not mandatory, that there might be no fiscal impact. Arguably, though, if in one interpretation that I heard from the gentleman from DPSST, if we are in the situation of then having to change the training for all of the officers and add what is 11 weeks of training to the 5 they now have, there is a cost to that. I do not know what that cost is. I do not know how it might be phased, and I have not seen the fiscal.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Chancellor.
Thank you.
And I apparently overlooked Tom Hojem from the Oregon Student Association.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Hojem. I am with the Oregon Student Association, which represents the interests of more than 100,000 public post-secondary education students from across the state. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to explain to you some of the concerns students have about this bill as it's currently written. The college campus is a really unique place where students from across the state and across the country and across the whole world are funneled into one location and interact with each other on a day-to-day basis. Students are concerned that this bill, they recognize that it would expand the authority of the special campus security officers, but they're concerned that there isn't an attendance requirement that they have an equally comprehensive understanding of the students that they'll be protecting. On a college campus, you have LGBT students, you have international students, you have students from every community in the state of Oregon, and potentially every community in the world. And students are concerned that, the peace officer, just as a peace officer, a college campus is microcosmic of the entire world, and that's what students really kind of think, that the role of DPS officers are pretty unique in that respect. And just as a police officer in Pendleton should understand Pendletonians and a police officer in Portland should understand Portlandians, so should a police officer on a college campus have at least a modicum of understanding of many, many different cultures and many different perspectives. A great example that I usually use is eye contact. In European American culture, eye contact signifies trust and respect. In many cultures, including some, most of the rest of the world, eye contact is actually seen as a sign of aggression, and the aversion of eye contact is seen as respect. And the thing about these little misunderstandings is that they can eventually escalate into something tragic. So something so small can easily escalate into something that could be very bad. And so students would like to see a change made to this bill that would require something like that. Now, we have been speaking with representatives from SEIU, and they are amenable to this, and we will be working with them to see if we can get something more specific further on. But I just want to make clear that students would really like this to happen. And additionally, just one note on the fiscal impacts. The first thing actually students asked me about when I explained this bill to them is that, will this affect our education if this drains money away? And I haven't seen fiscal impact yet, but if there is a significant fiscal impact, our students made it clear that they will not be supporting this. So I just want to make that clear. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And I have one more. Teresa Lucas from Western Oregon.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm hearing a lot of people talking about these officers going back through the full basic police or the 16-week basic police. That isn't what this bill was designed to do. This bill was designed with the current training levels, providing the additional training on how to write a violation citation, on how to better be professional at their jobs, the cultural diversity. We are not asking for our officers at this time to go through the basic police course. That is not what we are asking for. So fiscal impact, as far as the 6 weeks of training or 7 weeks of training, OUS already pays for that. There will be no other additional training from DPSST. There will be some certification. There will be some in-service training for the current officers.
but we are not asking these officers to go back through a 16-week DPSST course under this bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Lucas, please.
Hi, my name is Tracy Lucas, and I go to Western Oregon University. First, I'd just like to address Mr. Chair and the committee. I am a college student, and I was not asked by OSA how I felt about this bill. They have not talked to all the students, so they don't know. I'm very involved in school, and nobody asked me. I just know because I work at the Capitol. And personally, I know all of the campus public safety officers, and they do a great job, and they're very friendly, and they work really well with all the students on campus. And I feel like, as a girl, I want them to be able to protect me as much as they can, and I support anything that would allow them to do that. I also feel like they're putting themselves on the line for us, and we should do whatever we can to be supporting them in that. I also feel that even if it costs a little bit more, that's my safety you're talking about. That's how safe I am on my campus, and you would sponsor it if it was for not on campus, and I don't see that there should be a difference if it's just a little bit more to take care of your students, because we are, you know, we're Oregon Oregonians, and we want it too. So that's just my feeling. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate that. We don't have the fiscals. This bill's not ready to move today. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3071. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3263.
House Bill 3263 extends the statute of limitations for certain sex crimes if the defendant is identified on the basis of DNA sample comparisons. We do not yet have the fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Go ahead, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I'm a House representative from the Albany area, House District 15. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you about House District 3263 today. First of all, before going further, Steve Dole from Crime Victims United approached three of us on this committee to sponsor this bill. And Mr. Chair, you're one of those, and Representative Krieger and myself are the other two. But between the three of us, we have 86 years of law enforcement experience. So to me, it makes sense that Steve approached us and asked us to sponsor this bill. As you are aware, last session, this body extended the statute of limitations for seven different crimes, all sexual crimes, to 25 years. This bill removes the statute of limitations if DNA evidence is present in a case for four of those seven. And all four of these are extremely heinous crimes. Rape, first degree sodomy, first degree unlawful sexual penetration, and first degree sexual abuse. You know, obviously, I mean, collaborating evidence is going to exist as you move forward once the DNA is matched to continue with prosecution. But one thing I do want to share with you, too, before I stop, that DNA evidence is evidence. And with that, don't forget what we learned as recruits with the Oregon State Police, and that evidence is the means sanctioned by law of ascertaining in a judicial proceeding the truth reflecting a question of fact. And that's where the DNA comes in. That helps us to get to where we want to go. And I would appreciate you moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, President of Crime Victims United. Happy birthday, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'm feeling a little underdressed here. Maybe you can send me the memo next year. When an Oregonian, one of your fellow citizens, is murdered, their life is stolen. When one of your fellow citizens is raped, their soul in many cases is stolen. It's a murder of the soul. You've all heard testimony previously, and you know what the studies show about the effects of rape on victims. I won't go through that. Many are damaged for life. many of these, as I indicated in some testimony about a week ago on the parole board, we have to represent in parole board hearings. They can't even show up for those hearings. Some are able to come out the other side and be strong. And we have three of those women here today who are very strong women who are going to be able to testify to you about their experiences. Over the years, I've had many victims, primarily women, ask me, why do we have a statute of limitations on rape? And I can't give them a good answer. But last year, the Gilmore case brought this one more time into focus. Mr. Gilmore was known as a jogging rapist, and besides the three victims are here today, we know that he has at least five other victims, at least. There may be more. With that, I won't labor my testimony, and I'll turn it over to the three victims. Thank you very much, and I'd ask you to move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Danielle Tudor, Tiffany Edens, and Colleen Kelly, please. And you can go in any order. Just please identify yourself for the record.
Did you want to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Danielle Tudor, and I am a requester on House Bill 3263. I would like to thank the committee members for the support of this bill and specifically thank my own State Senator Monroe and Representative Smith, who is here today. It is a great honor and privilege to stand before you today and speak on behalf of a bill that I am very passionate about. My story began in November 1979. It was a usual evening for me as a 17-year-old. When I came home from work that day, instead of going with my parents to visit some friends for the evening, I decided to stay home, watch a movie, and go to bed early. It was my senior year of high school. However, my sense of security and protection in my own home was shattered that night. It's amazing to me how within a matter of a few minutes your life can change forever. I would later learn that Mr. Gilmore had other victims previous to that night and others afterwards. The known victims would eventually reach eight altogether. Mr. Gilmore made an attempt at a normal life for a few years before he attacked Tiffany Edens. In 1986, Mr. Gilmore was finally taken into custody and charged with the rape of Tiffany Edens. But here is the rest of the story you need to know. Gresham police had no leads as to who attacked Tiffany. They sent information about the case to Portland police, asking them to check their files for similar attacks. As fate would have it, the detective that worked the cases from 1978 to 1980 received the information and remembered these previous cases he had worked that were unsolved. After my attack, I supplied the police with a composite sketch of Mr. Gilmore. Detective Donahue pulled over a suspect shortly after my attack because he matched the description and the sketch. That was Richard Gilmore. Mr. Gilmore had no record at that time, so Detective Donahue had to let him go. But he wrote Richard Gilmore's name on the back of that picture and kept it for future reference. I was Mr. Gilmore's only victim who saw his face uncovered. Before my attack in 1979, he also attacked a woman in 1978 where a fingerprint was recovered from that crime scene that also became an important piece of evidence. Detective Donahue sent this information he had from previous cases to the Gresham police. The detective working Tiffany's case immediately recognized Mr. Gilmore's name as that of his next-door neighbor and as an individual applying to become a Gresham police officer. Mr. Gilmore lived across a field from Edens. Detective Long got Mr. Gilmore to come in and get his fingerprints and photo taken under the pretense that it was all part of the application to become an officer. They found that he was a fingerprint match to the 1979 rape, and Mr. Gilmore was arrested. Here is why I am a supporter of House Bill 3263. The key evidence in the capture of Mr. Gilmore came from cases that Mr. Gilmore could not be charged for because of the statute of limitations had already passed. Mr. Gilmore confessed to our crimes and even took police to show them seven places where he had broken in and raped women. As a victim, justice comes from the fact of knowing your perpetrator has been caught and is paying for the price of his crime. When we went to trial in 1987, each of Mr. Gilmore's victims had to testify and relive the memory of something you try very hard to forget. All eight of us experienced a horrible crime. We had the courage to report our attack and go through the proper legal channels. However, from eight victims, we were reduced to just one voice. How is it that someone we know who is guilty by evidence does not pay for his multiple crimes? Consequently, Mr. Gilmore can now apply for parole every 2 years and can likely be out of prison within eight. House Bill 3263 has the power to prosecute rapists with proper DNA evidence. And as it stands now, there is only a period of time, and that is the deciding factor between legal vindication or absolute injustice to victims of first-degree rape. Tiffany, Colleen, and I have become the names and faces associated not only with Richard Gilmore, but House Bill 3263. Having to speak to the public about your experience and its details is never a pleasant undertaking. However, it seems to me a small price to pay if by sharing my experience with others, it leads to a greater good. And today, that greater good is the passing of House Bill 3263. It will ensure that in the future, criminals like Richard Gilmore will be tried for crimes they are guilty of with proper evidence, regardless of time elapsed. We owe it to our sons and daughters and future generations to help ensure their security and safety. There will be more Richard Gilmores of this world, no doubt. But let us send a strong message now to future generations. There is no passing of time or years that lessens the crime or its effect on victims. And the public, I believe, has always been ready for such a bill as House Bill 3263. I have personally received a lot of support and encouragement from the community to pursue this change in the law to ensure that a Richard Gilmore situation doesn't happen again. But for Tiffany and Colleen and myself, we will be left with the task at fighting to keep a serial rapist in prison where he belongs as long as possible. The reality is, however, one day Richard Gilmore will be out. This would not be the case if House Bill 3263 had been in effect at that time.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and committee of the members of the committee, my name is Tiffany Edens, and I am in support of House Bill 3263, and I am a requestor of the bill. I want to thank the committee's support in this bill, and particularly want to thank my senator, Senator Devlin, and my representative, Representative Bruin, for their support. I was raped when I was 13 in my home by Richard Gilmore. You heard some of the history in Danielle's testimony, so I'm not going to go into that. It changed my life. It altered my life negatively for many years and still is. Not only did it affect my life, but it has affected my children's lives now. So it's always reaching. It's always reaching. It always touches those that are close to the victim, and it doesn't stop. One of the things, I'm sure that you're very familiar with the parole board issues that we had last year, and what we did learn, because Gilmore was not convicted of those crimes, there's a scoring, like a risk test. It's called Static 99. And what that did for Gilmore was it reduced his risk factors, and ultimately, by law, he would not have to register as a predatory sex offender. Now, he is a predatory sex offender. He went out, he chose his victim, he stalked me, I know, for 2 weeks, and he broke in and he took what he wanted. And it's just a shame that we have the victims, we know that the crime was committed against people, and yet you can't do anything because your hands are tied because of a statute of limitations. Now with DNA, I understand that the statute has been changed since 86 and 2007, I believe, and we're back again. But there should not be a statute of limitation. There should not be a year. That's one of the things. If you look at it as like a child's game of hide and seek, the winner is the person that can hide the longest. And that's not right. That's not what we should say to Oregon's community. What you're putting, the statute of limitation puts a time limit to the crime, to the validity of the crime against you, for men and women and boys and girls. And Gilmore's victims, we were all young girls. We were all children. We weren't women at the time. We're women now, but we weren't women then. And rape is degrading and sick and disgusting, and nobody should have to endure that and think that if somebody can hide long enough, they're not going to be, justice will not be given to them. And that's got to stop. We need to say to community of Oregon that we are here to support you. And rape victims, men, women, boys, and girls, there is no time limit for the pain that you have to go through and the pain of your family and the pain now of my children, the next generation. We're affected always like a murdered victim. He didn't kill me, but he killed a lot of me. And that's wrong. And that needs to change. And I think it would be a great change for Oregon, and it would say a lot. And I just want to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for listening to our stories today. I also want to thank my Senator Schrader and Representative Hunt, who I know doesn't sign on bills, and I do thank him for his consideration. I, too, was 13 years old, like Tiffany, when Mr. Gilmore broke into my home, violently beat me, raped me, and destroyed any aspirations I had of being a gymnast from permanent damage he inflicted on the lower part of my back. He destroys dreams. He destroys hope. And like Tiffany said, nobody should have to live through that and live through it for the rest of their lives. It affects family. It can destroy families. I'm in this fight. I do have a daughter. I have a granddaughter. I don't want to ever see them go through what I had to go through and live with on a daily basis. He destroyed a sense of security. He destroyed my soul. I am not the same person that I was at the age of 13 or striving to be at the age of 13. And a lot of people have noticed that. And then this past year, coming forward and going through all that with the board and trying to keep Richard Gilmore where he belongs in prison. And in my opinion, he belongs there for the rest of his life. This bill, 3263, can help future, hopefully there is no future victims, but can help those victims to have some kind of justice. Because I, for one, have never felt justice, even though he is in prison. Because I never really got a say. Yeah, we went before a judge. We gave our testimony, only to be told that it was past the statutes of limitations. Where's the justice for Danielle? Where's the justice for me or any of his previous victims? I thank you.
Thank you. And I want to thank you all on behalf of the committee.
that you put to comfort. It's very brave of you to do that. You put a human face on. So many times we're looking at bills and they're pieces of paper. We're looking at numbers on a wall that are statistics. And sometimes far too often the victims get lost in that discussion. Mm-hmm. And it's vital. And I want to also thank you for taking the time to go to the parole board and go through that once again. By doing that, you're keeping other women in Oregon and young girls safe. And we really, really, from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don Rees and Christine Herman.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Don Rees. I'm a senior deputy district attorney from Multnomah County. I'm the supervisor of the Violent Crimes Unit. I have a case right now in my office where a Portland woman was attacked in her home by a stranger. She was physically beaten, and she was raped in her own home. Her husband was away at work. She was alone. And after being beat and raped, this stranger attacker left her. She called the police, made a report, photographs were taken, evidence was gathered. She went to the hospital, was treated, and DNA was collected. The stranger attacker rapist left behind his DNA. But that case, which occurred several years ago, remains unsolved because there's no match to that DNA. The DNA of the attacker is not in the database. And although DNA is a very powerful piece of evidence, unless there's something to match it to, it doesn't provide a basis to prosecute a case. And unless and until whoever attacked that Portland woman has his DNA gathered, which would occur either because he's identified as a suspect and the police collect a sample of his DNA, or he's convicted of a crime in some jurisdiction, and then his DNA is entered into the system, unless and until that happens, that victim will not have justice, and at this time, that stranger, attacker, rapist remains at large. Now, we hope that sometime in the next 25 years, because that's the current outer limit based on our current Oregon statute of limitations with DNA evidence to identify the stranger attacker, we hope that within 25 years we'll have a case against that rapist. But we may not. So clearly it serves the interest of our society and our state and crime victims to expand the statute of limitations on a crime such as that. But what about the interest of the defendant? Because the statute of limitations is designed to protect the interest of those charged with a crime so that they can defend themselves against a crime. That's the traditional reason for the statute of limitations, as you know. And traditionally, there's been no statute of limitations, only in the most serious crime, that of murder, because the thought is that crime is so serious it outweighs some of those interests of the defendant. This bill addresses that, I believe, because it's limited to the most serious of sex crimes. As was mentioned, it's the first degree sex crime. So that means these are the crimes where there's either violent physical force, forcible compulsion, there's a child victim involved, or the victim is a person who's mentally incapacitated or mentally defective. So the most vulnerable victims, those are the kinds of crimes we're talking about, and we're also talking about the stranger-on-stranger crimes, which is why the DNA would be needed to identify them. And there has been a new understanding, as people have come to understand the serious nature of these sex crimes, that like murder, they have a lasting impact, and it would be appropriate to, as we've done with murder, expand the statute of limitations. We have seen cases where individuals have either stopped committing crimes, and so their DNA doesn't enter into the database. They've been deported from the United States. They have fled the United States. Or they have committed their crimes in a serial fashion but aren't apprehended by the police, and the DNA does not come into the system. And so while as a prosecutor of these crimes, I believe we would utilize this law rarely in those instances where a person, for whatever reason, remains out of the database and remains unidentified and unidentifiable by DNA evidence. When we do have that past the 25 years, it will be in that category of crime where I believe society will be grateful that we have the ability to seek justice for the victim and hold the perpetrator accountable. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. And I frankly am humbled to be here in front of you today following the testimony of the three survivors of sexual assault who you've heard from. I'm not sure that I can add much more to this from what they've had to say because they illustrate exactly why a bill like 3263 is necessary. I do want to point out that Oregon, if Oregon enacts House Bill 3263, will be in the majority of states. A total of 34 states have a statute of limitations that is equal to what 3263 is requesting or greater than, or in fact, longer. So we're certainly not in a position where we're asking the legislature to go outside of the norm with this statute. The other thing I wanted to just really highlight here is that, and Mr. Rees touched on this, is that sexual assault has the same sort of lasting impact on the majority of survivors as homicide does on survivors of homicide victims. It is not something that is likely to be forgotten. It is not something that is likely to be minimized. It is something that brave and capable people like those that you've heard from earlier today are able to live through and learn to cope with, but they will not forget it. And it defies logic to give a perpetrator of that type of crime a gift if he's simply clever enough to not get caught for a certain amount of time. The Sexual Assault Task Force encourages your support of House Bill 3263, and thank you all for your support thus far and for hearing from us.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Olson.
Just if I could ask Ms. Reese's question. Generally, I mean, you're going to move forward with this with DNA evidence. You're already going to have evidence that would corroborate where you're wanting to go. So, I mean, for prosecuting a suspect.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I'm not sure I understand your
okay.
question.
You're going to have other evidence there that's in the evidence locker that's been collected by the investigator, that type of thing. And if DNA evidence comes in, confirms this years later, I mean, the two collaborate each other.
Representative Barker, Chair Olson, that's a very good point. And in my example of this case we currently have, we essentially have a complete, in my view, very powerful case with photographs, medical history, documented statements. The only thing we're missing is the identity of the attacker, which can be established by the DNA that was collected at the time of the crime. That's what's contemplated by this change in law, are those cases where it's a stranger on stranger attack. The elements of the case are there, but there needs to be a proven identity by a DNA match. And as I was pointing out, most people are not in the national database. And until a perpetrator's DNA is entered into that database and is matched by CODIS or our state crime lab, then it really is a meaningless piece of evidence. This would give us the ability to pursue those cases. It certainly doesn't mean a person can't put on a full defense. It's one piece of evidence. It has to be corroborated. And the state would, of course, has to prove each and every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, even after 25 years.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Gail Meyer and Andrea Myers, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barkers, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here respectfully but in opposition to this proposal. The crimes of Mr. Gilmore or anyone like him or anyone who suffers from more crimes than is even covered under this are abhorrent. It is not the guilty that we seek to protect, but we oppose this because of the important parameters that are in our system. You heard some testimony previously that the law was amended in 2007 to expand it to 25 years. I will not go into the detailed history, but this law was amended in 2005. This law was amended in 2001. This law and the statute of limitations has been amended session after session incrementally. This now would remove the 25-year statute of limitations passed 2 years ago if the defendant is identified on the basis of DNA sample comparisons. By removing the statute of limitations and completely tolling the statute of limitations in these cases, it raises a number of concerns to us. First of all, the statute of limitations is an important safeguard. You just heard from the DA speaking about the need and the ability of the person accused of the crime to be able to defend themselves. And our criminal justice system has always worked on the balance of a statute of limitations, of which during that time a person can be subject to criminal prosecution. At the same time, it allows the victim to confront their accuser. It allows the accuser to call witnesses and prepare a defense. As we let more time elapse between crimes and the accused being tried, it becomes more difficult for the system to work. It becomes increasingly hard when memories are lost, witnesses have died, and exculpatory evidence is no longer available. It's been destroyed, it's deteriorated, it's gone. I've already discussed the number of changes in the law. I now briefly want to cover some of the concerns with. While we often talk about the power of DNA, and we do think it's a scientific tool, and we certainly have, ACLU has supported the use of DNA, I want to raise concerns that are reflected in more detail in the material I attached from the national analysis by the ACLU regarding the tolling of limitations related to DNA. Sampling handling errors. Errors in the collection, handling, and storage of DNA samples can result in incrimination of an innocent person. This has occurred in several cases. The stories I'm going to tell you, I am pleased to say, they have not happened in Oregon. But they have happened in this country with undoubtedly well-intentioned people prosecuting and seeking justice. In 2002, it was discovered that a 26-year-old was mistakenly charged with multiple felonies because the Las Vegas Police Crime Lab had switched the labels onto DNA samples. There's inadvertent transfer of DNA. Samples can be contaminated by the inadvertent transfer of trace amounts of DNA. And as DNA and the trace elements become more and more sensitive and DNA testing more prevalent, this becomes a potential increasing problem. There can be analysis errors of DNA. DNA isn't quote-unquote objective. It's an interpretation of results, which lead to some level of subjectivity. When DNA is typed, a computer-generated graph displays a series of peaks corresponding with alleles. or short repeating segments of DNA, and everyone has these segments at varying lengths. The computer labels the alleles based on the length, but there can be ambiguity arising from these graphs, especially in cases where there's a mixture of more than one person's DNA. Presence of one source of DNA can mask the presence of another, particularly when there's unequal amounts. Misinterpretation of DNA tests led to a false conviction of a man in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Timothy Durham was convicted of raping an 11-year-old. He was sentenced to 3,000 years in prison. He produced 11 alibi witnesses who placed him in another state of the time. The prosecution's case rested almost entirely on DNA, which showed his genotype matched that of the semen donor. But post-conviction tests showed that he should have been excluded, and reanalysis of the initial test showed that it was a misinterpretation that arose from the difficulty of separating mixed samples. He was released after 4 years. Reporting errors. Failure to report results of DNA tests in their entirety and the reporting of misleading or inaccurate statistical information has resulted in the conviction of innocent people. Josiah Sutton spent nearly 5 years in prison for a rape he could not have committed. His conviction was almost entirely based on the DNA test performed by the Houston Police Lab. Reanalysis showed that the lab technician in this case had mistakenly reported that his DNA profile was included in the profile of a semen sample taken from the back of the car when the rape occurred, but it was not. Now, the examples above are not intended to imply that DNA testing is not a valuable scientific tool. DNA, when done correctly, can be highly accurate. However, the error rate is not zero, as it is often assumed, and false positives can and do happen. We've seen that with what we've often, many of us have considered the science of fingerprints in this state alone, being a science that has been established that if it's your fingerprints, that's clear. But Mr. Mayfield will tell you otherwise. So we know the power of science to be used to convict, but we need to be concerned about when science and human error enters the equation. The potential for error, however, can be significantly increased in cases where there is little or no other evidence against the suspect and where there is significant time lapse between the crime and the identification of the defendant. When we told the statute of limitations for cases involving DNA, it makes it harder to explain why a match is not really a match. Errors that might have occurred in sample collection and analysis might be impossible to uncover when the lab analysis and law enforcement personnel involved in the collection and testing are no longer around. A crucial witness might have died, not able to confirm the innocent person or an explanation for inadvertent DNA transfer may no longer be found. Retesting may not be possible because DNA does degrade over time. So you may have the DNA test, as they've talked about. They're waiting to get that match when the person gets into the system. But if that person cannot have the match retested because the DNA evidence is degraded, it makes it nearly impossible to, in this case, I will say the words, prove your innocence. We recognize the power of DNA as a tool in our criminal justice system, but we must balance the power of technology with a defendant being able to defend against cases arising years ago and the process and the system that we have put in place in this country and that we believe is so important, and which is why I'm here today respectfully urging you not to proceed with House Bill 3263. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. And I'd point out that Mayfield's fingerprint exonerated him. I mean, the FBI made a horrendous mistake in their initial identification, but the scientific fingerprint didn't convict him. It cleared him. And I thank you for all your testimony. I'm a little surprised you didn't bring these items forward when you were arguing for criminals, convicted criminals, to be able to use DNA forever and ever to prove their innocence if it isn't so good. I'm just
Chair Barker, please, members of the committee, please understand, and we do have other DNA legislation. I want to reiterate, the power of DNA and the scientific tool, when done accurately, is an amazing tool to convict. And when we discover years later that it could not have been a match or that the DNA couldn't have been tested at the time and it proves that the person isn't that person, that's an important tool years down the line. It's
It's much harder to prove your innocence when the DNA test says it's you than when we discover that there's a glitch, there was a problem, and we don't know who the DNA evidence was of someone 40 years later, but we know it's not the person incarcerated. And yes, thankfully, Mr. Mayfield was never fully prosecuted. His life and the moving story about what happened to he and his family is moving, and thankfully the Spanish police got it right. But I probably, like many of you, when I heard about it and heard the fingerprint match, made the assumption that, wow, they've got the fingerprint of the guy, and we know that science has been pretty foolproof and used in courts and accepted in courts. So it's really likely he's not guilty. So please do understand, we understand the dynamics here and the power and the amazing benefits that DNA has had to convict people who are guilty and to exonerate the innocent. Okay.
Ms. Beyer.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We would also respectfully weigh in opposition to House Bill 3263, but in doing so, we want to commend and give due credit to the courage and the strength and the fortitude of the three victims of the of Mr. Gilmore that we heard today, Ms. Eden, Ms. Tudor, and Ms. Kelly. As I listened to their testimony and the strength in their voices and the clarity of their comments was nothing other than inspiring, and I give them due credit. I really do. I'd like to make three points with respect to this bill and why we oppose it. And the first is to point out why, quite frankly, the statute of limitations is more important in sex cases than really in almost any other kind of crime I can think of. I'll explain that. To also call attention to the committee that this very same bill was before this committee 2 years ago. And also to give just a brief history of the length of the nature of the amendments as it's related to statute of limitations on sex crimes. As to my first comment, quite frankly, the statute of limitations is more important in sex crimes than really in almost any other. And the reason is innocent, law-abiding people engage in sex all day long, in different circumstances, in different places, with different partners. And that's not so with other crimes. Innocent, law-abiding people do not engage in burglaries. If you find someone's fingerprint on the inside of a stranger's house, that's a pretty good indication they shouldn't have been there. And if they were to be prosecuted 25 years later, it would be difficult for the defendant to suggest that he had a reason to be in some stranger's house. Innocent, law-abiding people don't engage in embezzlement. And so if you have a bookkeeper who's filtering a business's checks into her own personal account, that's difficult to explain. And if you wanted to prosecute that 25 years later, it would be hard to defend. Innocent, law-abiding people don't engage in the drug trade. So if you end up with cocaine and the compartment of your car, that also is pretty, statute of limitations isn't really going to help you one way or the other. But what's unique about sex crimes, and I'm talking about adults here, is that innocent law-abiding people engage in sex. And every instance of what we heard today of the proponents of this bill, they were discussing along the broad continuum of sexual encounters between man and woman or man and man, woman, woman. Of all the proponents here, they were discussing about the very rare instance when the initial encounter is hostile and criminal from the beginning. The woman is sitting in her bed, lying in bed, someone crawls through the window. The hiker who's pulled into, you know, the bushes and raped. But what we do know, and I think it's irrefuted, and I know that law enforcement personnel on this committee would probably agree, that stranger-to-stranger sexual encounters is the rare case. In most instances, when adults engage in sex, it's with somebody that they've encountered that they know. They've had an acquaintanceship. And there's a reason how and why these two people have initially gotten together. And in most instances, those initial encounters are friendly, they're social, and they're mutual. So the truck driver who goes through Pendleton during the roundup is going to have an encounter with a woman that's going to have a story attached to it. There will be other witnesses. The sailor who gets off the ship at Rose Festival and trolls through Portland with his buddies is going to have an encounter with a woman. Generally, will be favorable and social and friendly at the beginning. There will be witnesses. There will be a story there. The college kid who joins his cousin and he goes to a fraternity party at OSU will have an encounter with a woman. There will be other witnesses. The encounter, initially, will be friendly and mutual. 25, 26, 27 years later, establishing identity does not help anyone reestablish the circumstances of that sexual encounter. Again, there are those rare cases where from the beginning you know this was a hostile criminal act. But in most other instances, there's a social and agreeable and mutual basis for these two people to be together. Something happens later on in the course of the night that leads eventually to an allegation of rape. But the question is, what's that something? Where and who are those witnesses? And those are the cases where you absolutely fundamentally need the good wisdom of the 12 people from the community to make that determination. You need a jury trial to make a determination whether or not there is a crime here. So the reason we have statute of limitations, witnesses die. Right now the law is it's 25 years later. But if you do extend it indefinitely, witnesses do die. And this is where the defendant then, the identity and the identity alone does not establish all the circumstances of the events for that 12 people on the jury to make a determination as to whether or not a crime has occurred. Years ago, this committee was faced with the very same bill. 2 years ago, the Sex Abuse Task Force proffered a bill. It was House Bill 2153, which would have done the same thing. It would have eliminated the statute of limitations for a greater body of sex crimes. And there was, last session, a work group that was comprised of the stakeholders there, and that consisted of the Sex Abuse Task Force, the District Attorneys Association, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the ACLU. Consultation was had with the Crime Lab, with the Oregon State Police, and a compromise agreement was reached of extending the limitation period, which then was 6 years, to 25 years, where there was a match through DNA. OCDLA agreed to not oppose that amendment in exchange for the amendment being proffered. We are somewhat surprised and disappointed that there are some of those stakeholders in that agreement who are not resting on that agreement this session. But as a body, the legislature decided 2 years ago that 25 years was the right thing to do. You were approached with a bill that would have eliminated the statute of limitations entirely, and instead you determined that 25 years was the right length of time. This DNA match has caused this body, the legislature, to look at this. In the past, in 1991, the limitation period for adults was 6 years, and then in 2001, and I quite frankly do believe it was in response to the Gilmore situation, in 2001, there was the exception given for DNA matches, and the statute of limitations was extended then to 12 years. And then again, 2 years ago, it was extended from 12 to 25 years, and now the invitation again is to extend it to eliminate it entirely. But because the limitation period can be so essential in sex crimes, that identity can be the only hole you need to plug on those very rare limited cases where the encounters are hostile and criminal from the beginning. But the bulk of the cases are not that way, and the identity alone is not going to fill in the entire picture, and those 12 people on the jury are going to need more information. And if you eliminate the limitation period entirely, you are robbing the defendant of the ability to recreate the circumstances of that event. Thank you.
If they are not able to bring forward that full picture before the jury, I would expect a jury of wise people would certainly take that into consideration. And I'll remind you, these are rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, sexual abuse in the first degree, so they're not social-friendly, known-to-known encounters.
But
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Representative Barker, the point of it is our statutes make no distinction between stranger-to-stranger rape and marital rape or date rape. So the fact that these two people don't know each other at all or know each other very, very well, it's still rape one. And so my point being, these are the serious of the most serious crimes, and they do attach very serious penalties associated with them, but not all rape, most rape encounters are not stranger-to-stranger rapes. And that's my point.
Representative Stigler.
I understand the point you're trying to make, but I very respectfully disagree with it and very strongly disagree with it. We're talking about DNA that would have to be gathered at the time of the alleged commission of the alleged offense. We're not talking about DNA that's gathered somewhere down the road. If there's an, these are all of these crimes either involve forcible compulsion or they involve children under certain ages. So we're talking about the most egregious of these. So the DNA to be at all something that could be utilized is going to have to have been gathered at the time of the alleged commission of this crime. So I understand the point that was made about potential contamination, all that exists no matter when. But the bottom line here is I don't see the logic connection between the position you're trying to make and the fact that this DNA, it's not just a matter, I think the term you used is that it's an issue of identity alone. You're going to have to assume that the police have done their work with respect to the allegations that are made, and I can't imagine that you're going to have a friendly situation that a week later somebody's going to try and turn into a forcible compulsion of a forcible rape and expect to have DNA evidence. I mean, there's not going to be DNA evidence available at that point in time. So, and if there are holes in it, I guess I'm a little bit offended by the logic here, and I understand your position with respect to tolling of statutes and all the problems that you see associated with that. I think they're on the flip side of it as well, that they involve the prosecution as well, and any prosecutor is going to try and prosecute a case based solely, if there's no other corroborating evidence, they're going to have a hard time at it. But I just, that's more of a statement and not really a question, and I apologize.
Can I respond? Thank you. Representative Barker. And Representative Stigler, I appreciate what you're saying. Your point, I believe, is that you're only going to have a DNA sample to compare if the woman made a complaint close within the time of the encounter and made an allegation of rape, because that's the only time you're going to have a sample of DNA from which to compare later. There are cases, I've defended them, bar pickups, after the encounter, sometimes within 24 hours later, sometimes longer, it's underwear, whatnot, the allegation is made. It is not an instance where there's bruising, scarring, cut marks. It's an allegation of rape after an encounter in a parking lot, and the truck driver is on his way to Montana. It's your proverbial one-night stands. And those are the cases where there is a reason why we do have a limitation period. There are cases where it is so obvious it's a forcible, non-consensual situation. The only thing you do have to set, the instance that Mr. Reese discussed, is you have the whole case made up, you just don't know who it was. Those, I understand, are the focus of this bill. My comments are, that's not the entirety of case that's going to get scooped up within the provisions of this bill. There are your one-night stands that will get caught up in this.
Can I respond very briefly, because Representative Stigler, you did mention acknowledging the concerns that I raised regarding mishandling, degradation. The concern I want to tie back to that, at least for you on that issue, is it's going to be a lot easier, I think, for a defendant to uncover the mishandling, the improper reading, the testing, the witnesses related to the crime lab or other places,
in a shorter period of time if they you know, are.
But those same concerns, respectfully, follow up, Mr. Chair, respectfully, don't come into the argument when you're talking about utilizing that same DNA for exoneration. And I we don't need to have the debate here.
But hopefully we'll have it in a few weeks when we bring our DNA retention. But it's I understand that, and I'm happy to sit down and talk with you about the distinction. ACLU takes both of our positions and our role very seriously and carefully. It is important for a defendant to be able to point out the errors. And again, Oregon, I'm pleased to say, we don't have the histories of the Oklahoma and the Illinois uncovered here at the crime labs and other places where we could expose that.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These type of crimes are some of the worst of the worst. They affect women's lives, as you heard, for the rest of their lives. Some of them never get over it. It affects their children and their families. And if DNA evidence is up of a, such a condition that it does convict at 25 years or 50 years, I'm very interested in that, because most of the time you'd have to have some other corroborating evidence, a fingerprint, a witness, something else, a license plate, some other thing that would go along with that in order to convict at a later date. It wouldn't, very rarely would it be just the DNA. The second part was, you talked about the sailor at the Rose Festival, the truck driver at the Roundup. Those are adult to adults, but when you start talking about young girls, I'll just use the age 16 and under, they do not have that right to have that relationship, nor does anyone who is an adult male have the right to establish a relationship and take advantage of them. And so for me, when you're talking about my granddaughters, which I think I got 7 of them, 3 daughters and about 5 foster kids, that girls that were, you know, I really understand how that could impact their lives. So anything we can do to catch those people and not allow it to go on. Now, you heard that this name, I can't remember the guy's name, this multiple times. And so I think we, regardless of what we do, we really need to be looking at, there's a difference between these things when they're under 18, 16, wherever year you want to pick, when that relationship can't legally be made. And how does a 13 or 12 or 8-year-old girl articulate it other than the DNA? Because there's no way she could legally do that, and there's no way that any male could legally take advantage of her to have that DNA present.
Chair Barker, if I might, and Representative Krieger, I thank you for your comment, because when we spoke about this, I think it was yesterday, that's a point very, very well taken. If you find a DNA match on a 12-year-old, there's no basis to contend that that could have been, in any circumstance, a legitimate consensual sexual act. So I think there's a lot of room for discussion here about whether or not the real question is whether or not the divide should be based on age. Because if you do establish a match 40 years later, it doesn't matter. That was a crime. And you don't need to really reconstruct the circumstances of that sexual encounter.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your testimony, Ms. Myers. I respectfully disagree with the testimony. And indeed, actually, I think it is logically flawed with respect to this bill. In that DNA is probative of identity, not the question of whether or not there is consent. Granted, other medical evidence is probative of consent, but this bill seems narrowly tailored, actually, to, because it removes the statute only when DNA is involved, to the class of crimes such as the proponents suffered, in which there's no question of whether or not there was consent. There's pretty obviously not consent in that case, but the underlying question that would allow prosecution is identity, and thus DNA is highly relevant and directly probative. You seem to suggest in your testimony that this would remove the statute of limitations for the majority of rape offenses, in which identity is actually not the question, but the whether or not consent occurred is the fundamental question. And DNA is not probative of those kinds of questions. And this bill is narrowly, is only applies when DNA is evident, is the relevant evidence. And so I simply don't think that your testimony actually applies to this bill as written.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I think I understand exactly what you're saying. My examples that I proffered, the truck driver on the way through Pendleton, the sailor through Portland, they may not, through the encounter and the time frame after the encounter, may not have been able to have established the identity of that perpetrator. So then if you ultimately get your match 27 years later, then you may need to, on the basis of the encounter, need to reconstruct the events of what happened. Not all cases have all of the indicia of forcible compulsion that the proponents were talking about.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Brief, please.
Again, so there, in proving, say, rape one, for example, of course, there are multiple elements in the crime. The DNA evidence, let's assume, just for purpose of argument, despite Ms. Meyer's testimony, that one of those elements would be the identity. Yes. It would prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. However, there's also a separate question of consent.
Yeah.
And I would frankly think, I mean, beyond a reasonable doubt is such a high standard of evidence that it would be extremely difficult for a prosecutor to establish, to meet that burden with respect to that element several decades later, if there was a credible defense, if there was a real question of fact in that case. I suppose we're now repeating testimony, but I respect your argument. I don't think that it applies to this bill, respectfully.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I wish that were the case, and history showed us that around this country, but the DNA innocence and exonerations, there are powerful moving stories behind those, and there were juries who sat there. There was, as I testified on the Senate side, a moving story on 60 Minutes a number of weeks ago of a woman who, when she was raped, the one thing she was going to do was memorize the face of her perpetrator. And he was brought to trial. She testified. He was convicted. He was able to get a new trial. They actually had evidence tied to another person. She again identified him, no doubt in her mind. He was exonerated with DNA evidence, and the powerful story, and I found so moving, is they speak together today. They made peace. He was released. Now, that was different in terms of witness identification, and I understand that, but a jury was convinced by that evidence at the time. DNA, because it is so powerful that we believe, and it is so often accurate, that I'm not sure we always account for the times when it may be inaccurate or improperly handled and misproperly read, and then that's the tension I'm talking about. So I've said that, and I appreciate the time, the committee.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to take my turn taking these brave witnesses to task. I've signed on to this bill because of the policy, and I want to get back to that. To me, the underlying reason for statute of limitations is not, and I know some of this has been said already, but to be engaged in a waiting game, but rather to be more clear about the elements required for guilt. And I have a question that may be repetitive that I'll come back to. But I also want to take the proponents to task, not the victims, who probably have a right to do whatever they want at this point. But I hate the politics of this deal. And the thing I wrote on the top of my page was, I should say nothing. And that's good advice. But I'm going to anyway, because I hate the politics of this deal. There are two things I hate about it. I don't like the idea of us making very complex negotiated arrangements and then coming back and destroying them later. I can imagine doing it sometimes, but it makes me nervous. Maybe this is one of those times. And that does not mean I don't support this bill. Second, I also didn't like the ads. I didn't like the TV ads. And I really probably shouldn't say that, but I didn't. And I really am nervous about in any realm, even these deeply passion-justifying issues, justifying us to negotiate on political or advocate on political issues at the point of a political gun. And if we make our policy decisions primarily because we are worried that later on somebody will do a TV ad that we won't be able to elect to a future office, we will make bad policy decisions over time. And I say that because I can say it on this one because I support it. But it makes me nervous on a bunch of the stuff we're talking about. Now, on the policy, it seems to me that because of statute of limitations, and let me say, none of that is to say that I don't understand the deep passion that goes on these issues on the proponents of the bill. I really understand and respect it. Back to the policy. It just seems to me that it'd come out of trial. If we don't have enough to convict, we have the DNA evidence. Is that what we got? Seems like it's come out of trial. We're not changing the burden of proof. If all we got is a sailor and a truck, right? And I don't know if that. I still worry that that victim won't get justice, right? I still worry that this is a relatively significant bar, that 30 years would come into play, that memory would come into play, that all of the things we're concerned about would come into play. And at some point we made a policy decision that murder, you don't get to hide and wait, right? And that maybe rape of a kid, maybe you don't get to hide and wait. And that seems to be a legitimate policy argument, despite my very also strongly held political aversions to some of these conversations. Anyway, so why don't we just resolve it at trial? Yeah.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Representative Smith. These are very scary cases. And when it is an allegation of rape, immediately I think the jury is very sensitized to the seriousness and gravity of the allegation. And the jury needs a full understanding of the encounter. Not always. Some of them, the graphic evidence and physical evidence of the event, it's so clear, it was unconsensual, you don't even have to think about it. As for those other cases, the jury needs to hear the full component of facts. And then there is why you need witnesses other than just the defendant and the complainant.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything further? Okay, thank you. I'll close the public hearing on this bill, 3263. And we'll hold over until Friday, House Bills 2428, 2796, and 2857. I apologize, those are here for those, but we ran out of time. And we will reschedule 3218 and 3299. Further business to come before the committee?
Hearing none.
Committee adjourned.